Get a free bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label Whiskey when you subscribe to The Spectator in our Black Friday sale. Go to spectator.co.uk/Friday.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Kate Andrews looks at Trump's cabinet appointments and asks, will nominee for Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent rock the boat? Mark Galeotti looks at the sabotage campaign that Moscow is ramping up against the West and wonders how Europe will respond. Following the surprise first-round win of Calin Georgescu in the presidential election in Romania, Adrian Pascu-Tulburi looks at the extraordinary rise of Romania's disruptor. Michael Hahn reviews two Irish bands that have been playing in London this week, the rap band Kneecap from Northern Ireland and Fontaines DC from The Republic. And finally, following the news that Smithfield Market may close, Olivia Potts provides her notes on the market that has been the staple of London's meat industry for more than 800 years. Up first, Kate Andrews.
How rare it is to be given a second chance. This is what the American people have handed Donald Trump. His second shot at the presidency means avoiding past mistakes, which in Trump world means finally harnessing the full power of the state. Even in the last year of his first term, Trump was struggling to fill all the political appointment vacancies he had at his disposal. This was the consequence of never developing a real plan for governing that went beyond chanting, drain the swamp. This time round, things are going to be different. Trump is announcing new departments and staffing them before he even re-enters the Oval Office. We are about to see a methodical revolution in Washington, D.C., which will involve taking an axe to state spending, as well as announcing a sweeping set of tax hikes in the form of tariffs months ahead of implementation. The world watches nervously. Claire Lombardelli, a deputy governor at the Bank of England, issued a warning this week suggesting such measures are not a good thing for any country, whether they are tariffs or regulatory or others. Her very political intervention comes as Trump announces plans to impose a 25% import tariff on Canadian and Mexican goods from day one, with an additional 10% on Chinese imports. He has appointed Jamieson Greer as his trade representative to help him do it. Greer, the protege of Trump's former trade chief Robert Lighthizer, is committed to returning manufacturing and industry from China back to America at practically any cost. It's a cabinet full of outsiders and rebels in practically every department, apart from one. After weeks of deliberating over who would fill the role of Treasury Secretary, the president-elect has chosen the hedge fund billionaire Scott Bessent. The appointment gives us our first look into how Trump will approach the economy in his second term. In most areas, he's opting for disruption, but his pick for Treasury Department suggests a more restrained approach. Elon Musk talked down Bessent as the business-as-usual choice. But that's what markets are looking for after 4 years of Bidenomics. Stocks and bonds rallied when the appointment was announced this week. Markets have a reason to think that his fiscal conservatism will balance out the president-elect's more protectionist impulses. Bessent made his name on Wall Street by betting against currencies, most famously by working on George Soros' team in 1992, when the investor made $1 billion in one day by shorting the pound. He went on to found his own firm, the Key Square Group, and became known among his peers as a student of history and economics. He taught at Yale briefly, leading him to believe that the only way to run an economy is to go for growth. He's a disciple of the late Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, whose Abenomics involved a three-pronged approach to fixing the economy. Bessent proposes his own 3-3-3 approach. Get the economy growing by 3% by deregulating, slash the annual deficit to 3% of GDP with spending freezes, and produce so much domestic energy supply it amounts to 3 million barrels of oil each day. This is not a protectionist agenda. It is closer to free market fiscal hawkism. Apart from spending cuts, it is also the approach Trump took in his first term. Much has changed since then. In 2016, Trump was weaker and his cabinet appointments needed to calm and reassure the party. In 2024, his selection of vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to run the health department and Fox News anchor Pete Hegseth to oversee the country's defenses are audacious reminders that he can do what he wants. But as much as Trump loves to rock the boat, he has always been hesitant to take risks with the economy. He talks the protectionist talk, and then cuts, tax, and deregulates. That was how Trump governed in his first term, and Bessent seems to suggest a return to that agenda. Still, it took some ring-kissing for Bessent to land the top job. Once a financial backer of the Democratic Party, he has become a vocal supporter of Trump. His Fox News article on tariffs, insisting they work as a negotiating tool with other countries, was curiously placed and timed just as his name was being floated on shortlists. Trump's most recent tariffs announcement, coupled with his other appointments, may mean markets recalibrate, especially if it becomes clear Bessent is more inclined to go along with the tariffs than to oppose them. If the incoming administration really does go ahead with double-digit import taxes, he can wave that 3% growth goodbye. The calculation made by many laissez-faire Trump supporters is that these tariffs are threats, not policy, designed for negotiation, not implementation. It's a huge gamble. Still, the markets continue to rally with a kind of optimism that can perhaps only be generated in America. What would Rachel Reeves give to capture even a fraction of that market response for her budget? The chancellor also likes to talk about economic growth, but businesses here aren't responding with such zeal. Investors are demanding a higher return to lend to Britain, evidence they are not convinced by Labour's plans. Businesses are confused, understandably, about how to reconcile the promise of growth with the tax increase on jobs, which the budget ushered in. That discrepancy was on full display at the CBI conference this week. The difference between Reeves and her new US counterpart will be stark, and there can only be one winner. If Trump does start trade wars, the UK will look sensible by comparison. If he doesn't, and Bessent is empowered to go for growth, Reeves will be left promoting a version of Bidenomics light all on her own, and almost certain to experience the same dismal results. America might prove that growth talk isn't just rhetoric, but real and tangible, which will leave European governments shaking. But the lesson goes both ways. Reeves is an important reminder for Bessent about what happens when the public turns against your policies. Second chances are so rare.
That was Kate Andrews. Next, Mark Galliotti.
When a DHL cargo plane crashed while approaching Vilnius Airport on Monday, killing one of the crew, it looked like technical failure. But given that Russia was believed to be behind a series of incendiary devices which ignited on DHL flights and in warehouses this summer, inevitably many feared Moscow's hand. The suspicion is likely to be the point. In the past year, the Russians have stepped up their disruptive activities in Europe, from cyber attacks to assassinations, with the apparent aim of generating chaos and a climate of fear as much as anything else. In February, a Russian defector was gunned down in Spain in what seems to have been a hit commissioned by Moscow but carried out by gangsters. In March, petty criminals hired by the GU, Russia's military intelligence, torched Ukrainian-owned warehouses in Leyton, East London. Moscow was also blamed for a subsequent series of arson attacks across Europe on everything from Polish shopping malls to a German factory. In July, US and German authorities announced that they had foiled a Russian plot to assassinate Armin Papperger, CEO of the Rheinmetall armaments conglomerate, an outspoken supporter of Ukraine. Although the circumstances are still unclear, two telecommunications cables across the Baltic have just been severed in what could easily be sabotage. Meanwhile, as the Cabinet Minister Pat McFadden warned the NATO Cyber Defence Conference in London this week, Russia has expanded its campaign of cyber attacks. Some are essentially intelligence gathering operations, but an increasing proportion seek to disrupt, such as the attacks on the Czech railways this year, or the regular spates of fake bomb scares, generating the kind of hypervigilance behind recent controlled explosions in Glasgow, Euston Station, and near the US Embassy, and a major security alert at Gatwick Airport. How do the Russians manage to maintain such a tempo of attacks? In part, by outsourcing to a motley array of patriotic hackers and outright cyber criminals. This is not just confined to the online realm. As the MI5 Director General Ken McCallum warned last month, this year has seen Russian state actors turning to proxies for their dirty work, including private intelligence operatives and criminals from both the UK and third countries. This is especially evident in the online world, with Russian ransomware gangs and other criminal hackers essentially being given a free pass so long as they are targeting the West. Yet it is also clear that criminals are being used more broadly, in everything from carrying out surveillance on behalf of Moscow's intelligence agencies to covering walls across Europe with divisive and anti-Semitic graffiti, from planting firebombs to smuggling in sanctioned microchips. It should not be a surprise that the Russians are turning to criminals and private investigators. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, some 750 Russian diplomats were expelled across the West. Since most spies work under diplomatic cover, this delivered a serious blow to Russia's espionage networks. Yet, we could hardly imagine that this would stop the Kremlin from trying to find new ways to operate. Many proxies are hired anonymously online, so that they may not even know they are doing Vladimir Putin's dirty work. Some have been carrying out surveillance under the belief that their clients are convinced their spouses are cheating on them or their employees are stealing. The real question is why Moscow has stepped up its campaign this year and what it could possibly hope to achieve. Does it honestly believe that burning down a shopping centre or daubing some graffiti will really make any kind of meaningful difference? The answer lies in Putin's perception of the situation. He appears genuinely to believe that an implacably Russophobic West is committed to confining or dismembering Russia, and that Ukraine is essentially little more than a weapon aimed at the motherland. Kyiv's intelligence services have been conducting a series of attacks on Russian military targets, officers, and outspoken cheerleaders for the war. This month, for example, a naval officer was killed when a bomb exploded under his car in Crimea. To Putin, a man who believes Ukraine is an artificial construct created by Lenin after the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution out of, quote, what is historically Russian land, close quote, these attacks could only be happening at our behest, or at least with our approval. A hawkish Russian think tanker close to the presidential administration spelled it out to me. You think you can get Ukrainian terrorists to do your dirty work and that we'll politely pretend that you're not behind it? It's time you got to know what it feels like to be at war. Besides, he added, what else are sanctions but economic and political warfare? You try to crash our economy and then whine if you get hacked? It seems that at some point in the middle of last year, a decision was made by the Kremlin to allow its intelligence agencies to go a bit feral, in the words of the MI6 director, Sir Richard Moore. In part, this is simply revenge against Ukraine's allies. But it is also something more strategic, what one could call the weaponization of inconvenience. There is a sense in Moscow that the West has become too comfortable with the war, that we regularly write off a certain amount of money and part of our military arsenal to keep the Ukrainians fighting, without really feeling the costs. One could argue against this conclusion. Ukraine fatigue is a growing challenge, likely to be magnified if Donald Trump unloads a greater share of the war's costs onto Europe. But it seems to be a belief held in hawkish circles around Putin. The campaign of cyber and proxy attacks is intended not only to further Moscow's usual goals of spreading division and demoralization, but also to convey to Europeans a sense that their country's continued support for Ukraine is affecting their lives negatively. A massive cyber attack of the sort that McFadden described, bringing down the national power grid, is unlikely because it falls squarely within the terms of NATO's Article 5 guarantee of mutual assistance. It also invites retaliation in kind, and it would be naive to presume that the West is not also seeking backdoors into Russia's critical national infrastructure. But what about a criminal ransomware attack on an NH pathology provider that forces more than 10,000 acute outpatient appointments to be postponed, as happened in June? Explosive packages on DHL flights that create delays for all deliveries? Cyber attacks on railway signalling and ticketing systems that could impose commuting misery on hundreds of thousands of people and large business losses? None of these comes anywhere near the threshold for direct retaliation. But they certainly make an impact, especially if we become so frightened of Putin's shadow that we ascribe every upset and accident to his machinations. This strategy helps explain why Americans have so far avoided the worst of the attacks. In the run-up to the presidential elections, Moscow had no desire for the limelight, and now it doesn't want to risk forcing Trump to take a firmer line. Europe has no such immunity. So, how should it respond? This month, my report, Gangsters at War, Russia's Use of Organized Crime as an Instrument of Statecraft, was published by the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, and I embarked on the usual round of briefings. After one at NATO headquarters, I was approached by two national representatives, one from a southern European country, the other from one of the Baltic states. The former was worried. What can we do against such a campaign? We can hardly fight back in kind. His more seasoned Baltic counterpart's reply was blunt. We know the Russians. They will keep up the pressure so long as they think it's working. You just have to refuse to let it work, to double down, not give up. Keep calm and carry on, in other words.
That was Mark Galeotti. Now, Adrian Pascu-Tilbury.
Strange things are happening again in global politics. In Romania, a former United Nations sustainability advisor who has made admiring remarks about the indisputably fascist 1930s Iron Guard movement has just won the first round of the presidential elections. If you like Andrew Tate, the notorious manosphere influencer who also happens to be a Romanian resident, you'll love Călin Georgescu. A trim 62-year-old former national judo champion, he likes to post videos of himself swimming in ice on TikTok, and he caused particular consternation by making what critics see as carefully coded remarks in praise of Corneliu Zela Codreanu, the Iron Guard leader, and Marshal Ion Antonescu, who allied with Hitler. "I cannot speak about martyrs," he said, nodding towards a law that prohibits Romanians from speaking out in favour of the Iron Guard. But saying the unsayable is a key part of Georgescu's appeal. His victory would represent a significant repudiation of EU economics and the West's support for Ukraine. Similar to the Trump campaign, Georgescu has focused on the exorbitant cost of living and bringing about peace through strength. His message resonates particularly with younger, poorer and less educated voters, of which Romania has plenty. The speed of his ascent has made liberal heads spin. Until recently, Georgescu had been bobbing along at 2 or 3% in the polls. Last Wednesday, he reached 7%. Then Sunday's exit polls showed him at 16%, and the final tally put him on 23%, considerably ahead of the mainstream candidates backed by the established parties. The runoffs will now be a two-horse race between Georgescu and the reformist Elena Lasconi, a former journalist leading the liberal, pro-Western USR party. Lasconi took 19% of the vote. Much therefore depends on how the votes from the other parties fall. Though his brand of nationalism has previously been too strong meat for the nationalist Aur party, which he left after its senior figures criticised him for being too pro-Russia, Georgescu should be able to count on the 14% of votes cast for them. That would take him to the high 30s. The other main candidates are now likely to ask their voters to form a united pro-Western front, put aside party allegiances, and vote Lasconi. It is not guaranteed, however, that voters will do so. Even if he falls short, Georgescu's rise represents another significant challenge to the post-Cold War order and what remains of Western values. Romania's path towards the West has been slow, but by regional standards consistent. NATO membership in 2004, EU membership in 2007, and strong ties pursued with America, culminating in the establishment, in 2012, of a military base hosting NATO and US Navy operations, a key target of Georgescu's ire. Regular visits to Romania can't fail to be struck by its rapid progress in recent decades. Roads paved, buildings modernised, service delivered, if not quite with a smile, then at least with less of a scowl. Prosperity came not just to the unscrupulous, thick-necked businessmen who popped up everywhere in the 1990s, but to the middle classes too. Arriving at Otopeni Airport in the early 2000s, it used to be striking how unwell people looked. 10 years later, there was optimism. Even levity. It was a brave new world. But a world not open to all. In hindsight, perhaps progress was embraced too unquestioningly. The standard of living rose, but unevenly. The young and the smart cleaned up, but it was no country for the old or the meek. And so the left behind looked to new worlds. Few returned to communism, the memory of Nicolae Ceaușescu, undoubtedly one of the most brutal communist leaders of the era, was still sufficiently raw. More turned to God in the form of the Orthodox Church, which took on new, militant tendencies. I recall visiting a flashy new monastery where it was preached, with a totally straight face, that it was a sin to use electric light or allow your child to play team sports. National myth-making is strong in Romania. You choose your trope. Plucky Dacians against all-conquering Romans. The island of Latinism in a slew of Slavs. The energizing life force of the Romanian peasant. Interwar Great Romania as the breadbasket and oilfield of Europe. The shame of being carved up at Yalta by Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin. And, most recently, Romania as the vassal of Western Europe, which takes its workers and chops down its forests while giving nothing in return. It is not difficult to see how all these myths combine to turn into grievances and then into a crusade. This is easy to exploit politically. Georgescu's background as an agronomist gives him a way in. "This is your ancient land," he says, "but malign external forces are keeping you from it." His three-word mission, food, water, energy, strikes at the most atavistic impulses. And his communications are devastatingly simple. How can you argue against bread? Or peace? Or indeed God? Romania is one of the most religious countries in Europe. Though its Orthodox Church has supported Ukraine officially, it is resolutely anti-Western. And Georgescu, descended from a long line of Orthodox priests, has taken care to side with the church and the village against the corrupting forces of the West. There has been no shortage of woke horror stories emerging from Western countries to help shape his narrative. On the possibility of, say, Lasconi taking over the presidency, Georgescu is scathing. "A woman cannot be president," he says. "The woman has another role to fulfill in society. She wouldn't be up to it." Such comments have a tendency to go viral. And it was on TikTok, used by 42% of Romanians, that his campaign really took off. Clips showing him on a horse, at church, taking ice baths and meeting villagers, reached hundreds of thousands of followers, before being taken down for falling foul of electoral laws. TikTok also allowed the mobilisation of the diaspora vote. In the UK, half of voters chose Georgescu, albeit on a minuscule turnout. Liberal Romania is, of course, horrified, but they should perhaps consider they have not themselves been without sin. There are two Romanias. Outside a handful of touristy Saxon villages, rural life is tough and occasionally brutish. Some cities are gleaming and energetically modern. Others are squalid. And too many in the nice Romania have treated the other Romania with contempt. The notion that noblesse might oblige is limited to a handful of dreamers and eccentrics. Will Putin get a new judo partner on the 8th of December? The numbers suggest, on balance, not. But if he does, it will go down as another failure for the too comfortable West.
That was Adrian Pascu Tilbury. And now, Michael Hann.
It was Irish Week in London, with one group from the north and one from the south. Guinness was sold in unusual amounts. Green football shirts were plentiful. And so at both shows was a genuine sense of joyful triumph. These were the biggest London venues either group had headlined. The Irishness was much more visible on stage at Kneecap. Not least because, as a proudly Republican group, they can't really not make a big deal of being from West Belfast. Their statements have prompted the inevitable fury from some quarters. Kemi Badenoch, as business secretary, refused to give them a £15,000 grant to help them tour, on the grounds that the British state should not be aiding those who despise it. That seemed to be a fairly pointless gesture, given that Northern Ireland Screen and the National Lottery had already spent nearly £1.6 million on helping get a sort of biopic of them made. It's also exactly the response they wanted. They sued, claiming Badenoch had breached the Good Friday Agreement. Kneecap are provocateurs, not terrorists. Their film spends just as much time mocking Puritan republicanism and the folly of encouraging the spread of the Irish language by teaching kids how to discuss turf cutting in their native tongue as it does on anything notably nationalist. The trio play themselves in the movie, and one of the running jokes is that one of them has a hardline loyalist girlfriend who requires him to shout IRA slogans at the moment of orgasm. They're also in a very curious place, because they're part hip-hop group, part political statement, part druggy city kids, and part comedy act. The film is very funny. It's telling that they were joined on stage by Corrupt FM, the group who made the BBC comedy People Just Do Nothing, about hapless, self-deluding rappers in Brentford. Both groups share the same love of the music and the same instinctive desire to play for laughs. It made for a strange evening. genuinely unnerving things would be followed immediately by supremely silly things. There was a lot of pro-Palestine chanting, which is to be expected. It was less felicitous to see the band lead the fans in a chant of "Ooh, ah, Hezbollah." Fellas, Netanyahu being a maniac does not make Hezbollah the good guys. It was no less facile than Oliver Anthony's crowd singing Joe Biden's a pedo in Shepherd's Bush earlier this year. And for those of us old enough to have used bomb scares as an excuse for being late for work on a regular basis, the sight of Irish tricolour balaclavas flying off the merch stand at 30 quid a pop was unnerving. That's not to take Badenoch's side. If you don't understand why Catholic kids from West Belfast might not have a lot of time for the British state, you maybe shouldn't be in politics. And nor was it an angry gig, it was a party with no sense of threat. The music itself is basic but thrilling, the hip-hop equivalent of a garage punk band. But what was truly notable was that at a big hip-hop show in London, I did not see a single black face in the crowd. Kneecap have excitement and verve and wit, but for all their love of music, they still stand outside hip-hop. I wonder what their future might be. I bet it's not as a purely musical exercise. Fontaines DC are the breakthrough rock band of the past half decade. You can measure their progress by the increasing prevalence of their t-shirts at festivals. And though I'd not been completely convinced by them live before, they were absolutely breathtaking at Ali Pali. Even as the older members of the crowd, not just me, I promise, got increasingly irritated by being shoved out of the way by large groups of enthusiastically drunk young men trying to reach the front. Their most recent album, Romance, supplied much of the set, and it leapt from the stage, the dynamics in place, the guitars moving from furious to dazed to delicate. Singer Grian Shatner's involved a Liam Gallagher-esque presence. A bit more movement than old Parker Lad, but the same I can outstare you intensity that somehow projects charisma without challenge. The set, which was paced perfectly, built and built to a ferocious climax of huge sing-alongs, people on shoulders in astonishingly large numbers. Fontaines DC feel very much like they're having their moment. There's a palpable air of certainty about them, a confidence in their capacity to be as powerful as a juggernaut without surrendering their immediacy and intimacy. Next summer, their shows are going to be huge and outdoor, but they carried off Ali Pali with gusto. I don't think the giant stages are going to worry them one bit.
That was Michael Hann, and finally, Olivia Potts.
Smithfield Market has been the beating heart of London's meat industry for more than 800 years. Located at the middle point of Farringdon, Barbican and St Paul's, the capital's only remaining wholesale meat market has survived bombings and fire, public criticism and a waning butchery industry. It has been pulled down and rebuilt and adapted to changing times. In continuous operation since medieval times, to call it an institution is an understatement. But this week it was announced that it will be forced to close its shutters for the final time. The City of London Corporation was granted the right to run Smithfield Meat Market by Edward III in 1327. Over the years, opinions on it have differed. In 1726, Daniel Defoe called the meat market, without question, the greatest in the world. But by Victorian times, the market had critics. In 1843, Thomas Maslin described Smithfield as that disgusting place, where one would find cruelty, filth, effluvia, pestilence, impiety, horrid language, danger, disgusting and shuddering sights, and every obnoxious item that can be imagined. There were calls for its relocation to outside the city walls, with animal welfare and poor hygiene the main criticisms. Smithfield, as we know it, was rebuilt during the Victorian period, equipping it for the more modern nature of trade. The Grade 2 listed covered market buildings were designed by architect Horace Jones, who also designed Billingsgate Fish Market, and opened in 1868. The market today is its own microcosm, trading in the twilight hours to supply meat to butchers and restaurants, with its own slang and enforcement officers. A plan has been in place for some time for Billingsgate Fish Market and Smithfield Meat Market to relocate to a purpose-built site in Dagenham, East London. But this week, the Court of Common Council, the decision-making body for the corporation, voted to absolve themselves of the running of the sites and called time on the move, citing inflation and rising construction costs. In 2028, the market will be closed for good. The process for doing so is not straightforward. The corporation's responsibility for the site is enshrined in the Metropolitan Meat and Poultry Market Act 1860. so the council will need to bring a private bill before Parliament to release themselves from the running of the market. Lawyers have raised questions about the legality of the vote, as no study has been produced into the importance of the markets to London's food supply and security. There have also been concerns over the use of public funds to foot the compensation bill for traders, reportedly around £300 million. The buildings will be preserved, but what about the traders? They find themselves displaced at a time when the independent meat and butchery trade is already struggling. You could argue that the closure is simply hastening an inevitable demise, that Smithfield too would eventually have gone the way of all flesh. But in the centre of London, where much of the trade is supplying inner city butchery shops and restaurants, where the demand for high-end butchery is still high, it's hard not to see the loss of this market as a true tragedy for a skilled and historic craft.
And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate, a review, and a follow. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.